from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. There's no hierarchy of pain. That's what psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb says is the most important lesson she's learned in her practice. And it's one of the recurring themes of her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. In it, Gottlieb traces the lives of four patients who have problems of varying magnitudes, but who are all grappling with universal questions of belonging and meaning. We'll talk to her about the advice she offered them and about her own experience in therapy following a sudden and painful breakup. That's all next, after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Psychotherapist Lori Gottlieb says that people come to her practice for many reasons, but their stories tend to share common themes, including emptiness, dislocation, and death. Her new book is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, and it explores her patients' overlapping struggles, and it also documents her own experiences in therapy when she seeks help after a sudden breakup. Lori Gottlieb joins us this hour to talk about her book, how she guides patients through difficult moments, and what it's like to become a patient herself. And welcome back to Forum.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Pleased to have you. And let's talk about the title. You really do need to talk to someone sometimes, and you did, and all your patients did. And it talks really volumes about, in many people's minds, particularly when they come to that crisis point or whatever it may be, the need for therapy.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that so many times people are afraid to go to therapy because they think that it's something that it's not. And one of the things I wanted to do in this book was to bring people into the therapy room so they could see that it's really this rich human experience. And it's not, I think, what a lot of the stereotypes about therapy are that tend to keep people away.
People tend to keep away also because it's very difficult to find a good therapist. I mean, you've written a lot about how difficult it is to find a partner, a man. We'll talk about the partner that you wound up going to a therapist because of, which is at the heart of your book, because of a breakup. But, you know, finding a good therapist is like finding a good partner in life.
It's so important. In fact, study after study shows that the most important factor in the success of your therapy is your relationship with your therapist, more than even the therapist training or their years of experience or the modality that they use, all of which are important. But you have to have a certain kind of relationship with your therapist for the therapy to be effective.
And you also write about what you call the hierarchy of pain. People go often to therapists or get off the dime in terms of going to a therapist because they're looking for some way of simply dealing with the crisis that they're in or the pain that they're in. And when I think about the hierarchy of pain, I think about, there used to be a guy named Henry Morgan who talked about having a toothache. And he said, when I have a toothache, it doesn't matter what's going on in Cambodia or in Darfur or wherever. You know, I've got a toothache. It's my pain. And this is fascinating in the way you present, because you're a very good storyteller, the way you present it in your own experiences. You're there, you're in pain, and meanwhile you're treating a patient, for example, who is dying of cancer, a young newlywed woman. And we all compare those things. Well, my pain isn't so bad when I think about something like that, but it doesn't necessarily work that way because you're the one who's experiencing the pain.
That's right. And I think that's one thing I've learned as a therapist is that there's no hierarchy of pain, that pain is pain. And, you know, it was interesting because you'd go from, or I would go from, this woman who was dying of cancer to, well, my husband never initiates sex, or I think the babysitter's stealing from me. But those things matter too, because they're not necessarily about the surface issue. It's sometimes it's about, what is it like when the person that you love rejects you? That's very painful. Or what is it like when the person you trusted most in the world with your children betrays you? And that's real pain. And I think so many people, it's kind of like if we have physical pain, we don't hesitate to go to the doctor. If you have chest pain, you're going to go to the cardiologist. But if you have emotional pain, sometimes people think, well, I have a roof over my head and I have food on the table. So, you know, I shouldn't be depressed, or I shouldn't be anxious, or I shouldn't have problems. But people do, and they should get help for it.
And you say pain is pain. I mean, you put it very bluntly like that, and that's certainly true. And you also talk about the connection between change and loss, which also ties in with pain.
Yeah, I think change is so hard. People wonder, people so often know exactly what they need to do to change, and yet they do exactly the same thing that they've been doing. So why is it that people don't change? Why is it so hard? And I think it's because change involves loss, that you have to lose something that's familiar to you, even if that familiar thing was unpleasant or miserable. It's really hard to go into uncertainty, to go into the unknown.
I wonder what you think about a statement from a book by an author named Ethan Kane. And Ethan Kane used to be here in the Bay Area, and now he's a professor of literature and creative writing, even though he's a Harvard MD. And he once said, people don't change, they reveal themselves.
Mm. I think people do change. I think that they reveal themselves first, and then they change. And I think that we always say in therapy, insight is the booby prize of therapy, meaning that if you just understand yourself, but you don't make changes out in the world with that understanding, the insight is useless. So you can say, well, here's why I am in my marriage. And then you go home and you act exactly the same way in your marriage. The insight is absolutely useless to you. You have to leave the therapy room and go make changes.
There is a thing I believe in therapy called a leap to hell. Suddenly you get the insight and things change, but they change very temporarily and transient. Yeah.
That can happen sometimes. I think mostly what happens is that people take a while to understand themselves. And when they do and they start making changes and they start taking responsibility for their lives, the changes are long term.
Well, let's talk about your own experience with therapy. We can talk about some of the patients that you write about here. And there's some fascinating stories, as I said. But and the stories lead up to, I think, some important conclusions, even though the lives are very different. But in your own experience, you were in what looked like, well, you were headed toward the altar and, you know, a really serious relationship with a great guy. You go into all of his assets and all the wonderful things about him. And that's the one side of him. And then the other side is you just thought, I don't think I want to be with a kid. You had a kid. And a kid is a very important part of your life. And so you were devastated, and devastated probably far more than you even knew, because when you went to see the therapist, you went to think, I'll just find out, get confirmed what a jerk he was, right?
I think so many people come to therapy for the reason that I did, which is for validation, that you want the therapist to take your side. And I talk in the book about the difference between idiot compassion and wise compassion. And idiot compassion is what our friends do. Yeah, he's a jerk. You dodged a bullet. But wise compassion is what we do in therapy, which is we hold up a mirror to our patients and we help them to see something that they can't already see about themselves. And it changes the story. I come from a writing background. And, you know, I feel like sometimes what I'm doing as a therapist is I'm helping people to edit their stories so that they come in with a faulty narrative. This is the story. This is the truth. This is the way it is.
You help them change the narrative.
Right, right. Because the narrative isn't serving them. And it's also a very narrow version of events, and it doesn't take into account everything else that's going on in the story.
And so we can get into, in therapy, multidimensional nature of that story and really move on from it.
Well, that's right. So in my case, when my story was, well, look at this guy, all of a sudden we're about to get married and he says, I don't want to live with a kid under my roof for the next 10 years. And you think, well, I wasn't hiding my 8-year-old, you know, for the last several years. So
he was playing Legos with your 8-year-old.
Right, right. But I think that there's more to that story, right? And so the first session with my therapist, I say, you know, and now I've wasted all this time and half my life is over. I'm in my 40s. And my therapist gloms on to that statement, half my life is over. And he says, I think you're grieving something bigger than just the loss of this boyfriend. And I was like, what are you smoking? But he was right. I mean, that's what our, so this book isn't a breakup book at all. I mean, the breakup is at the very beginning of the book, but, you know, the therapy goes in a very different direction after that.
As it so often does, and as it should. And I ask you, since you get into just it's kind of a sidebar here for the moment, you get into some dreams that you have and that patients have and so forth. And I was asked not too long ago to give a talk to the Psychoanalytic Institute, and I talked about dreams in terms of, well, not necessarily finding credible anymore the royal road to the unconscious. I think a lot of it's just flotsam and jetsam that you pick up and let out during your sleep and so forth. But you can do real dream work with patients, right? I mean, you can find things out still?
You can. I don't do deep dream work with patients, but I think that our dreams sometimes help us to see something almost like a pre-confession I talk about in the book, that we keep secrets from our therapists, from ourselves. Of course, we keep secrets from the world and we keep secrets from people close to us. But in therapy, sometimes we're keeping a secret from the therapist because we are keeping a secret from ourselves as well. And in our dreams, sometimes those secrets become, they come closer to the surface. And you can see in the book, there are several examples where I am keeping a secret, not really knowing that I'm doing so, from my therapist. And it comes out in a dream. And I realize this is really important.
And your therapist, who you call Wendell, is a guy who you looked up on Google and felt maybe that was not necessarily the smartest or wisest thing to do?
I did. I Google stalked my therapist. It's funny because as a patient, I did everything that my patients do with me, including Googling him. And I went down the internet rabbit hole. And I think it was because he told me that I needed to stop Googling the ex-boyfriend, that it was a distraction, which it was. And then I just typed in my therapist's name to the search engine. One of my colleagues calls the internet the most effective short-term non-prescription painkiller out there. And the hours that I spent Googling my therapist, I think, was very much for that reason. But I found out that his father had died at a relatively young age of a heart attack. And I had been waxing poetic in my therapy sessions about my close relationship with my 80-year-old father and how I was so glad that I had this time with him. And I was having this opportunity to say goodbye, in a way, to him. And I had no idea that my therapist had had this experience with his own father. So I started editing myself in the therapy room before I confessed. But I know that my patients Google me because inevitably they slip up. They'll say something like, well, you know what it's like to raise a boy in middle school, even though I've never said anything about whether I'm a parent or how old my child is or anything like that.
Talking with Lori Gottlieb, she's the author of Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. She's also a contributing editor and Dear Therapist columnist at The Atlantic, and we'll be speaking this morning, 11:30, at Town Center Books in Pleasanton and at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park tomorrow evening at 7:30. And we'll give you an opportunity shortly to join in here and join the conversation and raise any questions or comments you might have for Lori Gottlieb. Question about the methodology of therapy. How much does it really help you? I mean, I know some therapists are just more intuitive and have more of a sense of being able to read people, and it doesn't necessarily come from all of the textual stuff that they may have absorbed getting an MA or a PhD.
Right. I think that the training that we get is almost like if you're a pianist and you have to learn your scales really well, but then you improvise once you get really good at the scales and the theory and the technique. And that's what happens with therapy, too. And I learned a lot from seeing another therapist working with me after I had already established my practice, because it's one thing to go to a therapist before you really know what you're doing. But it's another thing to go when you are doing that job. And, you know, he was so himself in the room. He didn't cross boundaries. He didn't disclose things about himself, but he brought his whole personality into the room in a way that I think is really important for therapists to do. And it helped me to be myself in the room that way with my patients too.
And that has to some extent taken over the profession, whereas it used to be you come into the room and somebody lies down on a couch and you could be coming in with your arm in a sling and the therapist says nothing. It's just kind of a blank slate that you transfer things onto.
I don't think anybody really wants to go and talk to a brick wall. I don't think that's what they're going in for. I think they're going in for a very human connection and interaction. When Julie, the young woman that I was treating, who was this newlywed dying of breast cancer, you know, I cried in the room with her at times.
She also wanted you to be with her at her death, which is often a request that therapists would back away from, but you didn't.
Right. First, she asked me if I would stay with her until she died, and I wasn't sure I was the right person for that because I didn't do oncological therapy, and I had never really had that experience with a young person dying like that. But she didn't want to do all of the optimism and the pink ribbons and the affirmations. That just wasn't the approach for her. And so we kind of figured it out together, and it was this really profound experience. And I really couldn't say no to that. And I think that sometimes, you know, you can't stand on professional ceremony. You have to have boundaries and you have to be intentional about the choices that you make. But in this case, I wasn't going to deny her that.
And let's talk about John, another patient of yours, because here you are going through this breakup and you talk to this guy who's calling everybody an idiot and who really had a great deal of, I mean, one of the things I enjoyed about your writing is you sort of bring attention to yourself in ways that are, well, somewhat self-denigrating about your looks. I mean, you talk about John saying, for example, that seeing you as like having a mistress, but he would have picked somebody else as a mistress. So you talk about a job you had when you worked in television and somebody said you overheard, weren't eavesdropping, just happened over here, the guy who was doing the hiring say, well, I've got a smart one and a hot one. Which should I take, the smart one or the hot one? All this kind of sexist stuff. And he hired you and you wondered, are you not the hot one? And you felt bad about it. You know,
right. I was completely offended by that conversation that I overheard. But at the same time, when I realized that he was picking the smart one and I was the smart one, on the one hand, I was thrilled. And on the other hand, I thought, well, wait a minute.
You were the smart one.
I was oddly insulted.
Who was also a klutzy smart one in some ways.
Yes,
as you point out.
Yes, so I hadn't exactly shown my intelligence that day.
I mean, it's endearing. To read somebody who can be that self, self-denigrating, but at least aware of, in a way that you can put yourself down when you don't really need to do that. And you have this patient, John, and you know you're trying to listen to this guy, and it's exasperating. You're going through a personal crisis, and he's just saying things about you that aren't all that comforting.
Right. John was somebody who was about 40 years old. He was married. He had a couple kids. And he said he was coming to me specifically because I was a nobody and he didn't want to run into any of his high-powered colleagues in the waiting room. And, you know, he would insult me. He would belittle me. He was very hard to get to know. He was very abrasive. Everybody was an idiot. And the thing about John is I really wanted to tell his story because the way that somebody presents is a way of protecting themselves, how they behave in the world. Usually we do that because we're trying to protect ourselves, not because we want to be that way. And when you find out later in the book, without giving it away, you know, what the sort of trauma and tragedy underneath this is, he's the person that when people read the book, they love the most. And he's so hard to like at the beginning. And I think that's so important for people to see that there's so much more to somebody than what they present to you on the surface at the beginning.
Well, you say you like all your patients. You even had a guy who attempted murder that you liked because underneath the rage you saw some things that weren't.
Yeah. A supervisor said to me when I was training, she said, you know, there's something likable in everyone. It's your job to find it. And I thought, well, not everyone. That can't be true. But it is if they let me see them. So if they share their lives with me, if I can really see who they are, I've liked every single one of my patients. The patients that I have a harder time with are the ones that I don't know if I like them because they won't let me get to know them. So they stay on the surface. They run away from me. They don't want to do the work in the room. And I don't really know who they are yet, so I don't know if I like them. People, I think, hide their truth so often because they feel that they won't be liked if they tell you the truth of who they are. But that's so ironic because if you reveal the truth of who you are, you become so likable. That's the glue. That's what draws people toward you.
Because you get a special class of patients, too, and that has to be factored in as well. I mean, they're used to dealing with things in maybe a more accomplished way with a masqueraded self and all that.
Sometimes, not always. I don't really have I have a diverse practice. And I say that because I have a sliding scale also. Not everybody, you know, you can't have everybody be on the sliding scale. But I think that that's important that you see all different kinds of people. And I also think that people are more the same than they are different, which is what I was trying to show with these patients. The patients that I follow these four patients. I'm the fifth patient. But I follow these four patients who are very, very different from one another on the surface in terms of age and gender and personality and what they're dealing with in life. You have somebody who's in her 20s who keeps hooking up with the wrong guys. You have someone who's about to turn 70 and her adult children won't talk to her. And she's had several marriages and she's the most isolated person I had ever encountered in life, both professionally and personally. And she says if things don't get better in a year, she wants to end her life. And so you have all these different kinds of people with different problems. And I think the interesting thing is that we can all see aspects of ourselves in every single one of these people.
And you get to two sort of major motifs, so to speak, dislocation, emptiness, as well as death, which we touched on before. And people don't necessarily, when they talk about their lives or when they talk about what they present with and come in, don't necessarily see these underlying the surface in so many instances.
We have universal struggles that come up all the time in therapy, which have to do with how can I love and be loved? How do I manage the pain of my past? How do I deal with mortality and the fact that I'm not going to be around forever? And that's a big one, by the way. Grief and loss are huge. We all have loss, whatever that looks like. So there's a lot in the book, even though I think there's a lot of humor in the book, I think there's also a lot around how do we deal with the inevitability of loss in our lives.
There is humor. In fact, you were involved in TV writing at one point in your life, and I think some of your storytelling abilities and maybe even some of your sense of humor may be tied.
I was an executive, so I wasn't on the writing side. But I was involved in story. I think I was always involved with story. So when I worked as a network executive, I was working on a show called ER. And I spent a lot of time in the actual emergency room, and I was really interested in the fictional stories we were telling because I felt like they really captured the human condition in a really interesting way. But then when I saw the real stories in the emergency room, I was fascinated by those, and I went up to medical school and I came up here to Stanford. And when I got to medical school, managed care was this newfangled thing they called it, managed care. And I realized I wasn't going to be seeing patients in the way that I had hoped. And I was writing at the time, and I became a journalist, and I got to tell people stories. But as a therapist, I get to help people change their stories. But even though all these careers sound very different, they always had to do with the human condition and story.
There was also a story you were writing. Well, it wasn't so much a story, but a book when you went to see Wendell, the therapist, and it was a book on happiness.
Right. So I was under contract to write a book about happiness, and the happiness book was making me miserable. It was literally making me depressed. I couldn't write this book. I was starting out as a therapist, and I felt like the happiness book could not reflect the nuances of people's daily lives, what I was seeing in the therapy room. And also, happiness is beside the point. I feel like happiness as a byproduct of meaning or fulfillment is great, but happiness as an end goal is destined to be disappointing. And so I couldn't write this book, and I couldn't get out of my contract, according to the agent that I had at the time. She said I would never write another book, and I had to do this. And I had used that money to pay for my internship, you know, when I was training. And I was a single parent, and, you know, what was I going to do? And I ended up, you know, it's kind of like I was like the closet gambler who gets dressed for work every day and then kisses her partner goodbye and then, you know, goes to the casino instead of the office. My casino was Facebook or writing fabulously witty emails to my boyfriend. There was so much shame around that I would tell people, yeah, I'm writing this book. Eventually, I end up canceling the contract. And what I do is I do this book. I bring people into the therapy room, which is exactly what I wanted to be doing that whole time.
And the breakup might have been a catalyst to this book, obviously. It was.
Well, it was, unwittingly so. I never intended to write this book. Even when I canceled my contract, I had no idea if I would write another book or what it would be about.
Talking again with Lori Gottlieb, and let me open our phone lines and invite you, our listeners, to join us. You may want to talk about psychotherapy, may even want to tell some of your stories. In fact, keep them cogent, but we'd like to hear what you have been experiencing or have experienced in the world of psychotherapy, or questions to the therapist, or questions about anything that we've been talking about, or just feel free to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now, and we welcome your calls. 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Lori Gottlieb. She's a psychotherapist. She's also the author of a book called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and our lives revealed. She's also a contributing editor to a column called Dear Therapist with The Atlantic, and does a column called Dear Therapist, where people write into with questions. You're sort of like much more educated Ann Landers or Dear Abby or something like that.
Right. So it's an advice column, but I don't give prescriptive advice in the same way. I approach it the way a therapist does, which is that I'll help people to think about their problem in a different way, and I'll tell them what a therapist would be thinking if presented with that problem that we might not say in the first session because you might not be ready to hear that, but because I just have that one opportunity, I will give them my thoughts and help them to come up with a way of handling their problem differently.
Well, you think about the old saw that therapists become therapists often because they're neurotic and they want to find out ways that they can understand themselves.
I think we all want to understand ourselves, but I also think that that's a kind of an old trope of the therapist who's kind of a train wreck or a hot mess, and then they're very competent in the therapy room, but their personal lives are a mess. I don't know any therapist like that. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are bad apples everywhere. But most therapists are just struggling with the same daily problems of living that everybody else is.
And your son now is 13, recent bar mitzvah, in fact. And he is a young man who was selected by a sperm donor in terms of his paternity. And that's all very fascinating in your book because you write about it and you talk about the sperm donor being your sperm concierge. I kind of like that notion. But the idea of selecting, well, that kind of father, you wanted someone who had all these really good qualities, and sperm donor helped you with that. But here was somebody else. You wanted him to be good looking, too. He looked like a young George Clooney. So what does your kid look like now? Does he look like a young George Clooney?
I think he kind of does. I'm his parent, so of course I think he's very good looking.
And let me read some remarks that are coming in, and then we'll go to calls, because I asked about, well, naturally you ask about therapy and people want to tell you stories and they want to tell you their experiences, and I'm sure we'll hear some of those on the phones. But here's what's coming in by email. James writes, I have benefited from therapy over the years, but have found it also to be very expensive. Many affordable health care plans do not include psychotherapy as a covered option. Therapy is becoming less available to many middle class or poor people. Does your guest have any thoughts about how to bring equity to this important form of treatment? You mentioned a sliding scale, but not all therapists obviously have a sliding scale.
Right, and we can't have a sliding scale for every patient either. So it's a huge problem. It's a problem for me as a consumer of therapy. And I think it's our healthcare system in general. It's not just mental health, it's physical health. Our healthcare system makes it very prohibitive with high deductibles, very expensive monthly premiums. It's very hard. There are still the low-fee clinics and where I trained and where I think most people train, where you can get therapy for either no fee or a very low fee with trainees who are supervised by licensed clinicians. And that's always available to people. But I do think it's a huge problem, and I don't have the solution. I wish I did. I don't know who has the solution, because we all struggle with that, and I certainly experience that as a consumer myself.
If you have the solution, you have another book ahead of you, and maybe in Pulitzer Prize. Here's Robert, who asked, does your guest get permission from patients to talk about them publicly? If so, does she acknowledge their unequal and vulnerable position where they might feel compelled to give such permission? Simply changing names does not make it okay. If she has not asked permission, this is an even more unethical and disrespectful thing to do.
Right. So, yes, I have permission. Also, I don't write about anybody in the book that I'm currently seeing. So I didn't feel that I could write about people and do therapy with them and not contaminate the work in the room. In terms of asking permission, there were people that I didn't ask permission of that I obviously are not in the book, because I felt that I would be putting them in a vulnerable position by asking those particular people. The people that I asked, I didn't feel that would be the case, knowing what I knew about them.
And let's go to our callers and find out what's on their minds and what they may bring to the conversation here when we begin. Gwen, with you. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I'm African-American, and therapy, going to psychotherapy, is sort of frowned on in our community because we're supposed to talk to our pastor or just another friend. So I started going to therapy. I found a woman I like. She's was a Black Buddhist. And in the after about the second year of my treatment with her, I developed pancreatic cancer, stage 4. Now, I didn't even have to ask her to, be with me when I died. But she came to Ralph K. Davis, the hospital where I was, and continued treatment. And thank God I'm still here today. And then I got a Jewish man, and in the middle of our treatment, I realized that he had been my husband in a play years ago at Project Arto. So I believe in therapy. I continue it right now. Oh, my medical insurance paid for my therapy. But right now, the person I'm seeing, the sliding scale. So that is a big problem. And I give praises to therapy because I'm a teacher and I work with at-risk youth. And you tend to internalize some of the things that's going on at work. So that's it.
Well, Gwen, thank you for weighing in here on your own experiences, and I wish you best of luck with cancer. It sounds like, are you out of the woods in any way now at this point?
Yes, that was. I was 39 years old. I was really young, so I'm now. I'm out of one. I'm twice 39.
Oh, okay. Well, it's good to hear from you, and I appreciate your calling in here. And we'll go to more calls in just a moment. But when she speaks about being in a play with her therapist, it reminded me of something in your book that reminds me of a number of things. That is, when you see a patient in a completely different role as a civilian, so to speak, and I'm thinking about Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm, as a therapist. He's at the beach and he's wearing a Speedo and it just completely throws them for
That's right. There's a chapter in the book called Embarrassing Public Encounters, which is what happens when you see your therapist out in the world. And when we see our patients out in the world, because we have an experience of that as well. But I think it's interesting. I have a colleague who was trying to get pregnant, and she had gone through so much, and she finally was pregnant. She was standing in a Starbucks when her doctor called and told her that the pregnancy wasn't viable, and she broke down crying in Starbucks. And a patient happened to walk in, saw the crying therapist, made eye contact, and left, and never came back to therapy. And it's so interesting to me because obviously we don't want to see our therapist do that in the therapy room with us. But her reaction was so human. It was so – I don't think we want to be treated by robots. I think we want to be treated by people who understand what it's like to be a person in the world. And so for me, that would make me feel safer, that I would think, well, she can understand my pain even though it might be different from hers. But I think a lot of people are afraid of acknowledging that our therapists are human. And when they see our humanity out in the world – It's awkward. It's almost like when you're in first grade and you run into your teacher in Best Buy and, you know, she's with her family and she's wearing like cutoff shorts and it's like, Mrs. Jones, you know, she doesn't sleep in the classroom.
Well, what about you with your T-shirt when you came in with the T-shirt?
Right, right. Yeah. When I was wearing a pajama top that said Namaste in bed, which is not what, you know, not what you want your patients to see.
Well, that was a mistake, though.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Let me go to more calls. Let me take another call, and we get Susan next. Susan, morning.
Hi, good morning. I have some physical symptoms that are visible and documented that cause me pain, but keep eluding diagnosis by my doctors. And I keep getting sent away with no answers, which has led to me actually questioning my own symptoms and being less likely to go see a doctor. And also feeling an extra layer of pain because I have no answers. And I'm wondering, you know, what the guest has to say to the medical profession about how they can do better in seeing pain and the reality of it in their patients without making them less likely to get treated. I mean, is there anything that the medical profession can learn from the psychotherapy profession?
Yeah, so that's so interesting that you bring that up because in the book, I go through the exact same thing that you're going through, which is that I was having all these physical symptoms and every doctor that I went to would kind of, because they couldn't find an answer, they'd say, well, it must be stress. It must be anxiety. You must not be sleeping well. And I write about how, particularly with women, the medical profession tends to dismiss the concerns if they can't find a diagnosis. And there's a lot in the book about my journey as I go through this path of really trying to figure out, I know something is wrong. I know that there's a physical reason. And I'm being dismissed as sort of, you know, don't worry your pretty little head. And I think that that's a big problem with the medical profession. When I was in medical school, Stanford was great because we had this class called Doctor Patient, where they really want the people who are going to become doctors to understand psychologically what it's like when somebody doesn't feel well, when somebody's experiencing something, how sometimes it's scary when you don't know. And they really try to help them with the psychological part of dealing with patients. And it's a great point that you bring up. And I hope that you'll find physicians, and if you read the book, you'll see what I end up doing. But I hope that you find physicians who will take you more seriously.
And we thank you for the call. There are some really useful concepts in your book, too. Notions, in fact, if I could get to one, to clean it up for the radio, it's the idea that the queen has no, instead of the vulgar word, let's just say testicles. And that's an important concept to keep in mind.
Right,
and
right.
In terms of when you're working with patients and you're trying to bring them to greater enlightenment and illumination.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's like the perfect is the enemy of the good. I think that a lot of times people come in with these situations and they feel very trapped by their circumstances, but they're really trapped by the way that they're thinking about it. One of the things my therapist mentions is he talks about this cartoon from The New Yorker where he would just bring up these metaphors. I use metaphor a lot in my work too. I think it's very helpful. But he said there was this cartoon and it was of a prisoner shaking the bars, desperately trying to get out. But on the right and the left, the bars were open. And I loved that image because we all feel trapped by our fears, our past, our circumstances, our, you know, our partners, whatever it is, our jobs. And there is a way out if we're willing to look to the right or the left. And a lot of people, we don't realize that we say we want freedom, but sometimes we're afraid of it because with freedom comes responsibility. And one of the things that therapy really does is it helps you to take responsibility for your life, what you can change, what you can't change, the choices you can make, and how you respond to your circumstances.
Once again, when you have really good therapists. And here's Sven, who says, how do you know when it's time to move on from a longtime therapist? Will a therapist drop hints?
Yes, absolutely. So we have, you know, probably the worst business model ever, which is that from the very beginning, we want you to leave. And what I mean by that is that we don't want you to be with us forever. We want you to feel better sooner. And we want you to develop tools and skills and ways of thinking that will help you to be independent of us.
You're not talking about mercenary therapists who have few patients, are you?
No,
well, you're
no,
speaking the we here. It's pretty inclusive. So.
Well, I mean, I think that most therapists go into this profession for the right reasons and that we really do want to help people and we don't want to keep people there unnecessarily. So, for example, if somebody is coming in and they're talking about very surfacey things, one of two things might be happening. One is that they're keeping a secret because they're not talking about what they really need to be talking about. But the other thing is that maybe our work is done. Maybe they really don't have anything else to talk about, but they're afraid to say, I think maybe I'm done. And we want people to say that to us. We will say it with them. I think most therapists talk about, you know, progress as you're working with a patient. So it's not this awkward thing where you feel like I can't bring it up.
Now, you've got an active life. You're writing books. You're speaking. You're working for The Atlantic. You've got a son. How many patients are you seeing?
It depends on right now. I'm off for a book tour, but I'm there part time. I'm there like 3 days a week.
Laura wants to know, what are Laurie's thoughts about groups, especially if you can't afford one-on-one therapy? And we have a mutual friend, Irv Yalom, who's literally written the book on group therapy. But your thoughts about group therapy?
Group therapy is so interesting. I don't do group therapy, but
it is less expensive.
It is. Yeah, of course. But when I was training, I actually led groups and came up with a curriculum for group therapy at the center that I was working at. And groups are fascinating. You will learn so much about yourself and how you relate to other people and how other people perceive you. In the same way that couples therapy can be so enlightening in terms of learning something about yourself.
More of your calls. Let's get Rob on next. Rob, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to kind of respond to what what your guest just said about the whole idea of therapy being something that just can continue on forever. How can you tell the difference between a therapist that really wants to help you but just takes a while to draw things out of you or point you in the right direction and let you make the decisions and find the solutions versus one that sees you as a paycheck that comes in every week, pays your bill, and just wants to keep going it for months or years? Without directing the person to say, hey, you know, I think you have some good points here. You need to focus on this. Some people will just let you talk and they don't really guide you. And I think that people get afraid to even do therapy because they feel like they're going to get trapped in this never ending thing because the therapist isn't going to really try to help them. They just want to keep getting paid.
Yeah, I think it's a fair question, Rob. And we've been talking about traps people find themselves in. Sometimes the trap can be what Rob just described.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question because you have an active role in your therapy. So if you have a feeling that this person is just kind of skating along, you can mention that, or you can also, you know, it's certainly something to bring up with your therapist. But I really feel like there are so few bad apples out there. But if there is one, go see a different therapist. Make sure that you are, it's almost like informed consent. You want to know what is happening in your therapy, why it's happening, what are the goals. A good therapist will talk to you about your goals. A good therapist will say, will talk to you about your progress along the way. And if that's not happening, then you know, you might want to bring that up with your therapist. And if you don't get the response that you that feels comfortable to you, then maybe you want to see somebody else.
A few bad apples, but are those who are ineffectual or who just aren't that good bad apples?
They might not be bad apples. They might just not be as skilled.
We'll get some more calls on. Let me go next to you. Claire, good morning. You're on the air. Claire?
Good morning.
Yeah, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I recently left a position as a spiritual care provider at a local hospital, and one of the most profound truths I learned in that position was that there is a place that we can meet another human being that's really beyond their stature, beyond their place in life. I met with homeless individuals and inmates from local prisons and jails. And there was always a point of connection with every human being. And it didn't matter where they were from or what their background was. And I was just struck by some of the similarities between the experiences that I had and that your guests spoke about.
Well, thank you for that call, and I appreciate hearing from you. We'll hear from another caller right off. Deborah, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have a question regarding how do you find a therapist? Because there's different approaches to therapy with cognitive, behavioral, and other things which I don't even know about. And then secondly, when you're reaching out to a therapist and you may have issues which maybe leading you into a thought of, well, maybe I'm depressed, but you don't want to disclose that on every single piece of paper throughout the rest of your life. How do you approach that? And is the depression portion of this something that is actually clinically diagnosed by your therapist? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Lori Gottlieb.
Diagnosis is a tricky thing because if you're using your insurance, they're going to need a diagnosis. That code will go on your form, on your super bill. But I also think diagnosis is tricky because, for example, taking the case of John in the book, you know, he was very narcissistic. And on the one hand, it helps me to know what narcissistic personality disorder is like because it helps me to understand more about him and how to work with somebody like that. But I never want to lose the person behind the diagnosis because every person is different, even if they share a diagnosis. You being depressed and somebody else being depressed is going to look very different. There will be similarities. There will be some overlap. But, you know, I want to get to know you as a unique individual who happens to be experiencing depression. So I tend to use diagnosis kind of in the back of my mind, but it's not first and foremost. When I'm in the room with you, I'm going to be getting to know you as a person.
Don't know if you're aware of the fact that a number of psychiatrists got together to try to provide a diagnosis for our president. I'm just interested to find out what your reaction to that might be. I mean, they were thinking, is he narcissistic and to what extent? Is he sociopathic? I mean, they were considering all kinds of things. They came up with a new diagnosis that isn't in the books. It's called malignant solipsist. And you can invent the diagnosis, I guess, can't you?
Well, you can invent one, I guess, but you have to, in terms of getting it in the DSM, which is our diagnostic manual, it goes through a long process. And that gets revised all the time, too. I mean, there are things, bereavement used to be, if you were, after a loss, if you were still, had the symptoms of depression after 2 months, you know, they diagnosed you with depression as opposed to, you know, as if grief ends after 2 months. They've changed that now. It was called the bereavement exclusion. So it's always subject to change.
They should also change the whole idea of closure. I don't know if you feel the same way about
that. I write in the book that I don't believe in closure in that way. I think that every experience that we have in our lives informs us in a certain way, informs how we are, changes us, sometimes for the better, sometimes, you know, there's some lingering pain. But I think that this idea, it makes people feel really bad when they can't get to closure, because those experiences live within us in a certain way. Maybe not with the same sting, but they still live there. So I think that especially with loss, people talk about closure. How, if you really loved somebody, why would you want to have closure on that?
And you can have grief for a lifetime, you know, especially things of people losing a loved one and someone who is central to their lives. But these things catch hold of the therapy profession. I mean, closure became very big for a while, and a lot of therapists were using that. We're just like, for a while, a lot of therapists were sort of under the notion that many women who experienced traumas or nightmares might have been molested by their father, and it was sort of accepted as widespread, pervasive even.
And that's why I really wanted to write this book, because I wanted to bring people into a modern-day therapy room and dispel some of these myths about what it is and what it isn't that we do in there. There's so much misinformation out there about what therapy is, partly from media, partly from culture, partly from bad practices in the past. And I really wanted people to see what it actually is.
Here's Kali, who writes, "I have been in psychotherapy for a year and a half now, and my life has become more rich and fulfilling. Realizing I have been the victim of narcissistic emotional abuse at the hands of my parents has led me to reclaim my life and totally reframe the relationship I have with my parents. I finally feel like I'm on the road to becoming my true self." And here's a listener who says, "What should you do if your partner needs therapy but resists meeting?"
That's really tough, because often what happens is the partner hears it as a criticism. Something's wrong with you. You need to be fixed. And I think that the best way to approach that is to say to them, "I really love you and I see you struggling. And I wonder if you would be open to seeing someone for one session and just seeing if that might be helpful, because I don't want to see you struggle so much." And there, you know, it probably wouldn't happen in that one conversation. I think it's a series of conversations, but it comes from a place of love, not from a place of, "You're really irritating me," or "You're making our relationship really difficult," or "You're always depressed," "You're always anxious," "You're always stressed," or whatever the issue is. Go see a therapist. Let them fix it. You know, that's not going to be very effective.
There's also a moment in your book where you talk about the fact that many people, and this may have been the boyfriend's problem, they say, "It's not really your problem, it's my problem." Well, when they say that, what they really mean is, you're the problem.
Yeah, yeah. I think people say things and you don't really know how they feel unless you have those deeper conversations with them. Often people will say something to save face. So, you know, in my boyfriend's case, when he said, "I don't want to live with a kid under my roof for the next 10 years, that kid being my 8-year-old, you know, what I come to start to recognize in therapy is that that might have been a lot of it, but he also might not have wanted to be with me and didn't know how to tell me that. And, you know, and I think that that's important to, it's very healing in a way. It sounds like it would be very hurtful, but it's very healing when you know the truth. I think sometimes we're afraid of the truth because we think it's going to be hurtful, but I think knowing the truth is actually a relief.
But you got an epigraph here about honesty, in fact. What is it? I'm hunting for it in the book.
Oh, I don't know if I know it by heart. It's
you can paraphrase it.
Honesty is the point is that honesty might be harder to take, but ultimately it's better for us.
Yeah, it's Gretel Ehrlich. "Honesty is stronger medicine than sympathy, which may console but often conceals." Let me try to get another caller on, and that's you, Alexa. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having this conversation. I have been in therapy on and off since I was about 17, and I'm in my mid-30s now. And something that I've been negotiating recently is that when I was younger, I was seeing therapists who were older than me, and I was able to kind of feel like I was talking to someone with more wisdom and experience. And now both my parents were alcoholics. So I've got a lot of, like, trauma and things that I want to sift through, and my most recent therapist, I felt that she related to my story in a really wonderful way in a lot of ways, just because she had a lot of empathy, but I also found myself feeling like my boundaries were a little bit pushed by her sharing more information about her background, and I didn't want to feel that I had to tiptoe around her feelings in a therapy session, so I was just hoping to get some feedback on finding the right therapist and know that sometimes that can be a process. But as I get older, it seems like I need something different.
Self-disclosure is important to think about from both the therapist's perspective and the client's perspective. As therapists, we're very careful. We should be. It sounds like I don't know what happened with your therapist. But, you know, I think we're very strategic and very intentional about anything that we might disclose. For example, a colleague of mine was seeing somebody whose son has Tourette's, and my colleague has a son who has Tourette's, and she disclosed to this patient that her son has Tourette's because this patient was feeling so isolated as a parent and in her experience of the challenges of raising this child. And it created this incredible bond between the two of them. And the therapist didn't disclose anything else about her personal life. It was simply that she had a son who also had the same challenges. And so I think sometimes self-disclosure is really important, but I think if it feels indulgent or it feels like it's crossing a line, then you should listen to your gut and you should bring that up with the therapist or find a new one.
Yeah, therapists too can be narcissists and self-involved. That's, I think, the lesson to be learned there. A lot of lessons in your book and a lot of good reading in your book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Lori Gottlieb, she'll be speaking today at 11:30 at Town Center Books in Pleasanton and at Kepler's in Menlo Park tomorrow at 7:30. Her book again is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. And when we come back, we're going to update you on what's going on in Sudan. We're going to spend some time on that. And then we're going to talk about a new documentary called Unsettled about LGBTQ people, refugees specifically, who are, well, being resettled or trying to be resettled. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.